Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Hi, everyone. It's Sherry Coolidge here. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Second episode of the year. And today we are going to take a walk back in time. Our special guests today are a group of people doing something called Stand Up History, where they tell stories about the history of Cincinnati. But these people are stars themselves and not dusty old historians. Two of them are joining us, Molly Wellman, who you might know from her distilling and her craft cocktails and bars she's owned and her new gin, which we're going to get into a little bit. And so Molly and Greg Hand, who really is a premier historian of Cincinnati and has a blog about quirky, history stories related to Cincinnati. And so we're going to talk about their program, Stand Up History.
That'll be fun.
I know. They're good storytellers. And who do you want to have on your podcast? Good storytellers.
So. And it'll be fun catching up with Greg. Greg and I go way back. Before he became this kind of local legend history guy, he was in charge of the communication department at the University of Cincinnati when I was a student there working for student media. So it'll be fun to catch up.
So he has all the dirt on you? Is that what you're saying?
I mean, not all of it, but...
I'm sure you would hide. You would have hidden some of it, but he might know things.
Yeah. So we were just talking about how it's a little bit of a slow news week, a little bit of a down dip in the cycle. There have been some, interesting local stories.
I think it's always kind of quiet in January, I have to tell you. So I've been doing this job a very long time, general. I think we both know 24 years to be exact, because didn't I say it was my 25th anniversary and I was wrong?
The Enquirer, and you were wrong by a year. Yeah, you jumped the gun. But I know why you did that. You put us on notice that next year is your 25th and we better be ready to mark that appropriately.
Although you guys guess how I found out that it was actually, did I already say this on the podcast?
I don't think so. No.
This is how I knew that it was my 25th year. So I was convinced that it was with Gannett, not in my whole reporting career, not to age myself, but I was like convinced that it was. And then, Lisa, your executive assistant, the glue that holds the newsroom together, is like, no, it's 24. I'm like, nope, it's 25. So I go home and I worked with Alex Coolidge at our last newspaper. It's where we met. And so we're kind of like, he's making dinner and everything and we're in the kitchen. And I was like, how long do you think I've worked for Gannett? And he's like, since da 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 da. And I was like, why do you think that? And I was like, are you sure? And he's like, yes. He's like, I fell in love with you the very first day I ever met you when you started.
Oh,
and it was really sweet. And so
hold on a minute.
And so anyway, it was a very quick answer. And so we're going to trust him with my archival of work. And it turns out that Lisa was right.
What a romantic. That's a good Coolidge story right there. I mean, there hasn't been like a total lack of news. We had a little bit.
But it is quiet. So this is where I was heading with this. It is kind of quiet. So every January, it's a little bit quiet. I am working on something, but I'm like, oh my God, what if there's never news again? And I'm like, but
we know better than that.
I know better than that. But it does feel a little bit like, what are the big stories and everything?
I mean, there was a little bit, there was some fireworks at the commission meeting.
There were, but
let's
then they did.
Let's talk about that just briefly. So let me just set the stage a little bit here. We have a three-person county commission, which makes things interesting because they can never meet two of them because that would define a majority of the commission. That constitutes a majority. So they really can only talk about city business or county business, the business of the county when they're formally meeting together. So I've always wondered how that dynamic works and whether they get along or not. So we got a little bit of a glimpse into the interpersonal relationships of our commissioners when Stephanie Dumas, who has been on the commission, I think
6 years.
6 years now. Have what's normally just a perfunctory ceremonial vote to pick a president of the commission. And Alicia Reese was
her turn. Her, they take turns every 2 years, like for a 2 year period, but you vote each year.
So her turn, her turn came up, and usually they do a quick vote. It's unanimous, and they move on. But Stephanie Dumas abstained, and when asked why, said that, well, she said a lot of things, and it's all in the story, but basically it just boils down to she was questioning the leadership abilities of Alicia Reese, and she did not take kindly to that.
No, she didn't.
Awkward.
Yes. So I will say, I mean, that was a pretty big story that garnered a lot of readership. I mean, I have to say, after that happened, I was at Railroad Board, and we're not going to bore you all with that today, but you can read my story that's posting next week.
Wait, the city has a railroad board?
They do.
Oh, never mind. We've been down that track before.
But we're like all getting like text alerts as we're kind of like going into the meeting about what happened, and everyone's like, what happened? And I was reading the story and everything. And it was a big talker, but both of them, you know, for whatever their reasons, and neither one of us feel like commenting on that today, did really get back down to work. They had two meetings after that. So that was just, that happened, but, you know, they're working together.
Interesting. Very interesting. So when we have slow news cycles, which we tend to have in the beginning of the year, we like to kind of dig and find some stories that we might not normally do when news is breaking left and right. And you uncovered a interesting one, and I've had this thought on my own. So tell us about your story.
So the city runs the convention center, and there's been a lot. We've been writing a lot about what's going on with the convention center. It's going to close, and they're going to redo it and everything. Yeah. But we've asked the question, what's happening to the sign that you can see from the west side, which is my view when I come into the city. And it's the Cincinnati icon sign, and it's capital letters and lowercase spelling out Cincinnati. It's really lovely.
If our listeners are having trouble placing it, if you're on 75 coming north, over the bridge on the right-hand side, you will see on the side of the Duke Convention Center a illuminated, I don't even want to call it a sign. It's basically like the lights are arranged on the side of the convention center in such a way that it spells out Cincinnati.
And so it's always different colors. And sometimes you really can, like, it's orange on Bengals days and like orange and blue during, you know,
FC Cincinnati games.
See, sometimes you could tell, but sometimes it's very different things. And it really kind of came up. It was blue and yellow in honor of Israel. It's like, well, who makes the decision? Ukraine. Who makes the decisions and why? And so I just kind of talked to people at the city and everything, and put together it was fun little fascinating story. That sign's been up since 2004. There's 16.7 million million color combinations, that touch of a button.
You were wondering, as the curious reporter, who gets to decide what color that sign is?
It is. We answer that question, and who's asked for colors and what colors it's been and why. And so I went down a rabbit hole. It was very fun.
Not exactly a what I would call a big breaking news story, but a fascinating question. I think that's what makes a good reporter, Sherry, is someone who's curious and has the ability to get the answers. So I'm sure you've had to dig harder for some of the stories that you've written.
100%. And I think the city was like, What do you really want to write?
What's Sherry really trying to get from us? Okay. Well, they say that, you know, today's news is tomorrow's history. I've been waiting to use that segue now.
Nice.
Was that a good one?
Nice.
Yeah. Producer Phil just clapped his hands. Okay. So let's talk history.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited to welcome Molly Wellman, who you know from many adventures in Cincinnati, and Greg Hand, her partner. And he has his own many adventures.
Can you define partner? Mrs. Hand right now might be what?
How about unindicted co-conspirators?
Oh, there we go.
a fellow misfits.
I was going to say work partner, but fine. Yours, both of yours work too. So we got that. They are collaborating on something called Stand Up History in Cincinnati, and it is why we invited them. But we're going to hit on many, many topics today. But I'm very excited to learn more about Stand Up History and how we can learn more about Cincinnati. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Yeah.
So this first came on my radar that you're doing Stand Up History. I got a Facebook invite for an event next week as we record in Westwood at Muse Cafe, a favorite of mine. And I wrote a Woman of the Year about the owner.
She's amazing.
Yes, Shantae. Mm-hmm. So it kind of came across and I was like, we love these people. And I was like, we should have them on the podcast. So here we are. Thank you for coming.
Sure. Thanks for having us.
And before we jump into it, I'm kind of like thinking this is sort of like the meeting of like two Cincinnati legends coming together to work on something from different venues. You know, Molly doesn't normally need an introduction, but I would say you're the premier cocktail personality in town, among other things.
I like that title. Yeah. I make a lot of cocktails for a lot of people in this town. I've made them very happy, I'm pretty sure.
I mean, I've had one or 100, whatever.
And when I got back to town, you were owning and operating Japs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's where probably a lot of people know you from. But you do cocktails at events. You do... Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to talk about the gin that you're involved in, I hope. And Greg Hand... I haven't tested this theory, but I think if I go into the Enquirer's electronic archives and type in Greg Hand in quotes, there will be probably more hits than anybody else because of all your years being the spokesperson of the University of Cincinnati.
I was in charge of bad news, so yes.
Going back to when I was a student at the
University
of Cincinnati.
That's how we got to know each other. I covered courts when you were still doing that.
And I wanted to, you know, some full disclosure here. When I was involved in student media at the University of Cincinnati, it was during a phase where we didn't have a adult. We didn't have a media advisor. And so even though it was a independent student publication, normally there was an adult around just to keep us out of trouble. Not when I was there and not when I was editor. So I know that Mr. Hand, who I called you back then, was more than angry at us on occasion. So for anything we did during those unsupervised times in student media, you see, I want to formally apologize today, Greg.
So I'm going to pull you aside after. You can tell me all of the blackmail stories. Excellent.
And so in my mind, you know, just like you, when I stumbled across, hey, there's this cool thing, Stand-Up History, and two icons in my world anyway, teaming up. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the all-stars getting together here. So
I also feel like we should say Silent Phil, our producer, who we don't shout out every week, but we love and puts up with a lot from any podcast
from
at the Enquirer, any podcast. And I'm throwing everyone under the bus for this one. Was Mr. Hand your professor? Yes.
Oh, no.
It was the same as with Burl.
Oh. I was the source.
I see. Okay. All right. But you two know each other.
We do indeed.
I've heard many times that people were really afraid of you back in those days.
The fun part is they thought that I was not a real person.
Ooh.
students would get emails whenever a crime was committed on campus, and it was signed Greg Hand. And the students passed around this legend that this is just a made-up name. It's a made-up email account. And I did nothing to dissuade them.
See, we're already in Cincinnati history. The weird Cincinnati history, like right there.
I love that.
So tell us the backstory. Where did the idea of Stand-Up History come from?
Well, one day we were drinking.
All right. Don't you start out long stories.
No, so Greg has always been... somebody I always looked up to, reading all of his Cincinnati curiosities and everything in the Cincinnati magazine and anywhere. So one day I finally got to meet him at a lecture he did at the art museum. Yeah, it was the art museum. And I was like, I'm so excited I get to meet Greg Hand. And then it was myself and Greg and our other partner in this was Kent Malloy. And I think we were at Japs, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we just started talking about, wouldn't it be so cool to do a thing? And originally we wanted Kent, who's into film production and stuff at UC now again. Yeah. He's like, wouldn't it be great? We'll film it, and we'll film you and Greg and whoever other, you know, amateur historian in Cincinnati telling these stories. Because when Greg and I get together, we just start telling stories about old Cincinnati. Like somehow we went in the time machine.
We don't live in the 21st century.
No, we don't.
Molly and I have Sanborn fire maps and the 1869 Titus Atlas memorized.
Definitely.
That's the city that we see when we look out.
So let me pause you for a second, because were you always into history?
You know, I've always been someone who loves to know where things come from. I was that really annoying child that was like, why, Mom, why? Well, now I get to find out why. So I've always been somebody who's been interested in where everything comes from. And I love storytelling. And that's what history is all about. And I also am a true believer that you have to know the past to make better decisions in the present to have a better future. So I live by that. So,
and one of the reasons that we get along so well in this field is Molly does the homework. She really does. You can tell the posers in this business, the people who get all their information off websites.
Or Wikipedia.
You know, Molly's a person who will go to the archives and sit there for hours and hours and hours and actually do the digging and do the homework. And you recognize that she's got the real scoop.
Thank you. I was just there. I was at the Historical Society the other day for hours and hours.
And so when did you become, Greg? Because, you know, I have a 12-year gap in my Cincinnati knowledge because I was out of the market that long. So I leave the Enquirer, my first tour of duty, and Greg was the PIO, the public information officer for UC, you know, pretty clean cut. You know, I think you were sporting like almost a crew cut back then, clean shaven, you know, kind of wearing that standard university official attire. You know, I think you had a red tie with C's on it and stuff like that. So 12 years later, I blow back into town and Greg's wearing a fedora, has his big long beard, and he's writing history pieces in Cincinnati Magazine. And he's just like this historic savant kind of person. Am I describing that transformation accurately? And what led to that?
Yeah, I blame my co-author, Kevin Grace. He was the University of Cincinnati archivist for many years. And he was one of our early presenters in stand-up history. But Kevin and I worked on a couple of books about UC while I was at UC. And microfilm makes Kevin dizzy. And so I would always get the job of looking things up on microfilm. And when you find something on microfilm, you always find something else right next to it, right?
All the time.
All the time. And so I started this file of weird things that I found about Cincinnati. And when I retired, I was fooling around and I thought, well, I'll start this blog and I'll use up this file and that'll keep me busy for 6 months and then I'll do something else. And it's been 10 years and I'm still doing about 1,000 words a week on this thing and I keep finding weird stuff.
It just
this
never
was a
ends.
Very strange town.
It still is.
All right. So what came or how did this idea to get up and present in a fun, humorous, did you model it after something? Did you steal it from another city? Like,
no, we didn't steal it from another city. I never see anything like this, actually.
Well, before the day at JAPS that Molly was talking about, Kent and I had been talking about pitching an idea to Public Broadcasting System, PBS.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's
and
right,
we
yeah.
were going to do the old weird America.
That's
and,
right.
And
I'd watch that
this,
show.
This was going to be like the pilot episode. So we went to Myrtle's.
That's right, yes.
In the basement at Myrtle's mm-hmm. and did three or four shows
that were
actually videotaped. And Kent, who is a filmmaker and is now busy making films, has a lot of archival videos someplace mm-hmm. that will one day emerge and ruin all of our reputation.
I know. It's okay. I'm ready for it.
Or solidify them.
But since then, we've been like, we've done a few at JAPS. We did one big one at the Mercantile Library.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There were close to 300 people there that night. It was amazing. We don't charge any money to come and nerd out on history. We just show up, and if you let us talk, we'll talk.
Yeah.
But lately, we've been doing it at Muse. So,
Shantae Stallworth invited us in for a residency once a month, and she keeps inviting us back.
She must like us.
Well, that's fantastic. So we'll repeat this at the end, but your next event is Wednesday the
17th.
Thursday. What is
Wednesday?
It?
Wednesday. It's always
January
on a Wednesday.
January 17th.
Yeah.
At Muse.
At Muse.
All right. I am planning to go. I've been wanting to see this take place. And no admission.
No admission.
No.
That's
but we
good
do
price.
Ask you to buy a drink or something from Shantae to support
utilize
her.
Utilize the tip jar.
Yes, exactly.
I remind people that Shantae did not invite me because of my good looks.
No.
So can you give us a...
That was only one of the reasons.
Can you give us a small sampling of what people might hear? Start with you, Greg. And you don't... Not to like... You know, steal your thunder from this coming Wednesday, but what's something you might have entertained the audience with from your area?
There's kind of a theme that runs through all of my presentations, and that is that before 1920, this was a completely different city. Mm-hmm. 1920 is very much a breaking point, and before that year, this was a very different city. And so this week, for example, I'll be reminding people that it was highly possible up until about 1920 that Cincinnati could have become the Motown of America. This could be Motor City.
Yeah.
There were so many automobile manufacturers in Cincinnati that people have totally forgotten actually took place in this town.
I had no idea.
So cool.
All right.
I have a story about the first automobile that was driven down Vine Street in Cincinnati. You probably have it.
Well, you got to tell
us. Don't tease us now.
You got to tell us.
Go for
it. Cool. Well, I only know it because I had to do something for BMW store, which we love them. But they wanted to know some history about it. So there was a guy, I think his name was like, it was Wagon something. I'm sorry, I don't have it memorized, but, he worked for like, streetcars, right? And he lived in St. Bernard, and he would tinker around with engines, and he built this little tiny, very small engine, and he drove this contraption up Vine Street in St. Bernard, popping and hissing and wheezing and, people were scared to death.
Before
it was on a
Henry
Sunday
Ford
morning.
Yeah. Sold the Model
yes,
T. He was
big time.
He had his own motor vehicle that he was driving.
Yes.
And
it was.
That's fantastic.
It was, and his last name was, it was Wagon something. I wish I could remember his last name.
Yeah, but Cincinnati had,
so cool.
There was an automobile called the Sin-O.
Yes.
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Yeah, I remember.
And in fact, after they stopped producing the automobiles, the Sin-O workers had a baseball team, and they were more famous for their baseball team than they were for actually producing automobiles.
I love that.
The what's the park out there by Lunkin Airport? Armletter?
Yeah, yeah.
Armletter Park, that was a major truck manufacturer. The guy actually passed up an opportunity to become a billionaire. He was invited to he was invited to produce trucks at the beginning of World War I for the United States to ship over to European allies. And when he realized that they were not going to be used as ambulances but to transport munitions, he turned down the contract and his company went out of business.
Oh.
Wow.
That's crazy.
But he could sleep at night.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah, very much. I think that's so cool. I love listening to Greg.
All the things you find in microfilm.
It's crazy.
Well, Molly, give us a sampling of what you talked about.
So I've talked about, usually I, something I talk about something that has to do with alcohol. I don't know why, but it's kind of my thing.
You gotta stay on brand.
Yes. Yeah. But I do talk about like just interesting people also that I find everybody should know about, you know? This week I'm talking about pleasure gardens of the 1820s and 30s. So we had quite a few and they were kind of all the rage back then.
It sounds vaguely dirty. What are they?
I know, it really does. Every time I say it, they're like pleasure garden. Yeah,
there's like three things that came through my mind all at once. And I was like, no, I'm just going to let Molly keep going here.
No, these were gardens. They were a place for, you know, they didn't have saloons back then. They did have bars, or they had hotels, or they had the theater, you know. But these gardens were open in the summer. It was kind of like a precursor almost to the beer garden in a way, you know. Only it wasn't all about like German, but there were a lot of German people who did enjoy this. Like the Apollonian. I have a hard time pronouncing these. The Apollonian garden was, the proprietor was, you know, they were both German, the proprietors were. And it was built by Martin Baum, who, of course, was one of the first major millionaires here in Cincinnati. And he was German. So, but there were quite a few here in Cincinnati. So I'm going to be talking about this. Oh, and they drank a lot there. So,
but they could go there, have fun, enjoy the gardens, but yep. There'd be like a pop-up bar.
There would be a bar usually in the middle, and sometimes there was a theater, so you could catch a show or, you know, a play or, you know, what have you. But mostly it was like promenading through the garden in the shade and you know, schmoozing.
I'm all for bringing these back.
I'd love that. I know.
Sherry's Pleasure Garden.
Sure.
I think today people would still be wondering what goes on at Pleasure Garden.
Don't tell Alex, but it's fine.
Well, I think we already have a provocative headline for this podcast. It'll get people to download it. Since the secret pleasure gardens of Cincinnati.
Done.
That's fantastic. Well, besides doing stand-up history, you guys have both been pretty busy. We talked about Greg establishing himself as one of the premier historians now. You've been pretty busy. And at the Enquire holiday party, one of the highlights was people were sampling this gin that you've been working on.
Where was I? I was there the whole time.
Talking. You obviously were
over in the corner pouring little.
Yeah. I've had your gin, and it's amazing. But go ahead. I won't interrupt.
Producer Phil, we also had some of Phil's homebrew on tap.
Oh, nice.
Installing a tap in my kitchen bar. That's a whole other story, but we did that just for Phil's homebrew. And then we had some featured cocktails, and then we also had the gin. So when did you wake up and decide, I think Cincinnati needs its own gin and I'm the one to do it?
Well, it goes back to history again.
All right. I'm all ears.
But in a long, long time ago, 1870s, all right, Cincinnati was known, or a distiller here in Cincinnati was known for making the first official American dry gin. All right. Now, unless you're a big nerd about gin, that's going to be like, okay, gin, dry gin, whatever. But there's all different kinds of gin. You know, the majority of what people were drinking in America before, you know, before or in the 1800s was more of like a sweetened gin. It was always what we call rectified, blended. And usually there was something sweet that was added to it. Dry gin doesn't have any sweeteners in it. It was just about the dry, beautiful botanicals that let it shine through. And you did get some of that, like, but it usually always came from Europe. It always came from England, you know, London dry gin, you know. But in America, there weren't, as far as I know, I have never seen in a portfolio of a rectifier a dry gin. It usually is something that's sweetened, you know, or a Holland gin, which is more like dense. So I thought that Cincinnati, it needs their own gin. That, by the way, that distiller's name was Flashman, the same people who made the yeast.
Okay.
Yes. And they made this gin. And there's still Flashman's gin around, but it's really not that great. So we needed something that was as beautiful as Cincinnati is. And kind of this Cincinnati gin is a love letter to my city, because I really like alcohol, though I'm not a lush. I really love alcohol, and I want to start to bring that back, that culture back into our city. Not lushness, but bring alcohol.
Enjoying fine spirits.
Exactly. Yeah. Like we did back in the old days. So Cincinnati Gin, it just was a no-brainer. We have this beautiful conservatory. And when I go into the conservatory, a lot of people see plants. I see gin. So
you see the aromatics and ingredients to make a gin. So explain the connection to the conservatory.
So
is it as simple as this is where the flowers come from?
No.
Okay.
It's inspired by. And we have to say that it's all right on the bottle because when we launched this back in April, there was one lady who called in to the park board and said, "You has Molly Wellman over there picking all the plants out of the Grove Conservatory and making gin?
And your free time in the morning."
Just snip, snip. Mark House is over there. Yeah, get a little bit of that. Get a little bit of that. No, it's inspired by. But it was really cool. So I teamed up with Northern Row Distillery, which is over the Rhine. If you haven't been there, you have to go. It's really cool. I loved their gin. You know, it was awesome. So we went and toured Crone Conservatory. Mark House, who's the director there, he was amazing, gave us a tour. It was like the first time I've ever been there, but we learned a lot. We took a lot of notes. Mark picked some of the leaves so we could smell and figure out what we wanted. And with a lot of trial and error, that meant I had to go to the distillery and like taste a lot of different botanical blends that come through.
And you didn't call me for like assistance with that chore?
It was the on the down low.
Oh, so, I know, right?
It's top secret.
Yeah, I'm the wrong person to talk to if you're trying to keep something on the down low.
It's not true. We have a lot of secrets.
But that's how we came up with it.
Only Burl knows if you see, and very rarely in the newspaper, that something is sourced. So we keep that to ourselves
when
as
you
reporters.
Say that, you mean like an anonymous source?
An anonymous source. Mm-hmm. We very sparingly we use them, and it's very strict rules around them. But there's only one other person besides the reporter who knows who it is for the most part, and that is Burl. Yes, he knows a lot of secrets.
Occupational hazard.
Well, one day we'll have to sit and drink a lot of Cincinnati gin. We're just going to have to spill it.
There's like a statute of limitations. I've been here long enough where I can probably start talking about some of the early stories when I came back. All right. So, Greg, if people are intrigued and want to read more Greg Hand history, where would they go?
I usually just tell people Google Cincinnati Curiosities and you'll end up at my blog. It's most of my material, in fact, close to all of my material is reposted by Cincinnati Magazine. So if you go to their website, you'll usually find it as well. You've revived 5 o'clock tales.
Yes. I've started a blog too. We're not a podcast, what we're on right now.
Boy. One of those newfangled platforms.
So we're still fooling around with it, but yeah, I'm also going to start making some drinks at Arnold's, pop-ups on Tuesdays at Arnold's too. So, but yeah.
Well, you're talking about what you started during the pandemic everybody was,
Which
I was a huge fan of. I did a couple different things during the pandemic to stay sane. And one of them was I decided to up my cocktail game. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I saw your 5 o'clock tales. Is that what it's
called? Yep, yeah. 5 o'clock tales.
So I learned a lot, you know, so that was fun. I also like indexed my bobbleheads. That was weird. Like created a spreadsheet for that. But
that's
anyway,
important.
Those were my two things. But the one that, I got to tell you, Molly, it kind of spoiled me because now that I sort of know what I'm doing when I'm making a cocktail, I'm really like all of a sudden pretty snooty when I get a bad one and I'm out somewhere. I'm like, that's the best you could do.
Oh,
you know?
We're going to have to go out because I'm snooty about that too.
It's like, come on. Like I'm very, like I'll order a, if I think the cocktail, wherever I'm going, if I think the cocktail game is not up to my standards, I'll just get a beer.
Yeah.
So I ruined myself, basically.
Same way. If it's not up to, I'll get a whiskey. Yeah.
Yeah. Or something neat. Yeah.
I think I would be afraid to serve you a cocktail. I mean, you are well known enough to people.
Phil see me. I light things on fire when I make cocktails now and stuff like that.
What Greek cocktail did you make for us?
Oh, the Grexican?
Yes, it's very good.
I stole it from a hotel in Athens. It's tequila and a spirit called Mastika.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But anyway. We'll talk about that. So,
why are we drinking now? It's late in the day.
I'm laughing because somebody asked Molly if she's heard of a liquor.
Oh, but you're the first. You're the first one who said, "Yeah, I've heard of Mystica." Because I mean, you're not going to go into like, I've never seen it at the party source. Mm-hmm. I get it from my cousin who mails it to me.
Yeah, I have some friends who are Greek, and I've tried a lot of Greek spirits. Some I will never try again. Man. Rough sauce.
We'll have to compare some notes. Yeah. So before we started recording, Greg, you were talking about how when you retired from the University of Cincinnati, you started writing some history stuff. And I think you said you thought it would be a 6-month fad. Mm-hmm. And here we are 10 years later.
Indeed.
Where do you get your material from?
From the material.
Do you hang out at the library? Do you?
We have wonderful libraries in this city. The Mercantile Library has an amazing Cincinnati room. The History Library at the Museum Center is outstanding. Our own public library has a wonderful genealogy and history section. The old newspapers are just a constant source. Getting toward the end of the year, I was getting a little worried because I try to keep 3 or 4 things in the can so that I'm not panicking as deadline approaches every week. And I was running.
Yeah, I totally do that. Oh, no.
We all relate, Greg.
Really slow. And if you look at my to-do board down in the basement, I've got the next 12 posts mapped out because things just keep popping up.
I wish I could do that.
Well, there's no shortage of Cincinnati history.
No.
So that is very exciting.
Give you an example. My current blog post reveals that for about 50 years, Cincinnati was a major producer of goldfish, that there were dozens of goldfish breeding ponds all over the Cincinnati area, that there are remnants in a big field out in Mount Airy of where people used to. That all came out of a story in the New York Times that was talking about goldfish invading the Great Lakes. And buried in the story, it said goldfish were not introduced to the United States until the late 1800s. And I immediately thought, when were they introduced to Cincinnati?
Yeah.
So I went looking for the first mentions of goldfish in Cincinnati. And on the way, I found all these articles talking about this huge industry in Cincinnati. At one point, according to one of my sources, pet stores in Cincinnati were selling 5,000 goldfish a day in Cincinnati, all locally grown.
As pets?
As pets.
Like, did they put them in a koi pond? Or like a, you know?
Some of them were just
crazy
for decoration.
Yeah.
One of the major sources of goldfish in Cincinnati was florists.
Oh, that makes sense.
They would sell you flowers, and they would sell you a little
goldfish
finny flower. That
wow, that is so.
So that's how you find stuff. You just come across the line in the New York Times, and suddenly you have a blog post.
Pull the thread, yeah.
That's fantastic. You know, you mentioned the library, old newspapers. And we should do something more extensive on this when they're ready to like make them more available for the public. But, you know, we're in a new building here, and the old building we left had a huge area devoted to the archives and the library. And now we do everything digitally, of course. You know, we don't need librarians. And we used to employ 3 librarians at Cincinnati Choir
that
would manage all of this and pull files for you, which now, you know, it's all at your fingertips and even in your phone. But we had all of these clip files and photo files that we decided we're not maintaining them that well. We approached the Hamilton County Library and they took them on. Like, I can't remember how many skids of legal file boxes were stacked up, and they took them and they're going through them. And
I mean, for days on end, they came up and were packing up things, and I was in the newsroom.
Like a treasure trove.
And I was like, thank you for doing this to the person who's kind of boxing things up. And he's like, no, thank you.
Yeah.
He's like, this is a treasure. And I was like,
but there's an appreciation
for
history.
I thought
it's
that
for
too, but
here.
I was so thankful that they took them. And
yeah,
like,
we were very thankful. And
cared.
And the, you know, they're going to digitize a lot of it, but the great part about it is it's not just going to be an Enquirer asset, you know, this day, it's going to be the communities now.
It's so important because it is our history.
Absolutely. It's 100%.
Yeah.
100%.
I love that. I get excited just hearing about that. Like, Greg and I would be like, ooh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Let me see.
Well, we still have, you guys know Jeff Cease on our staff,
yeah,
I'm sure.
He's the best.
So he's the last person who worked as a librarian at the Enquirer.
Wow.
Now, he evolved. He's like, he does digital producing. He writes our history column.
I just had a reader this
morning.
He's
a tremendous resource for us. But when we were packing that library up, he painstakingly went through almost everything by one. And it was like each one was his child. He was trying to decide, does this go in the recycle bin or is it going to go to the library? You know, the recycle bin was probably this tall.
Right.
And the rest was to the library. There was no... But yeah.
But I did just have a reader just text me this morning, like kind of out of the blue, and tell me how much they love Jeff's column every week.
Wow.
That's the thing. That's what really keeps our audiences showing up is it really works for us because people really have this love of history, particularly the history of their neighborhood, their city, their street in many cases. And this is where we come in, they're very often totally mistaken about what that history was like.
Big time.
They have no idea what this place was like. And so when they hear about something going on in their neighborhood that doesn't match what they think is happening, they show up and enjoy the show.
Yeah. And I think our history also, I mean, there's so much still that is here from before we were here. And to put a story to that, why that's here, or it just makes your city have a lot more character. It makes it bigger. You can understand it so much more. And that's what I love about it. I know Greg and I we walk around Cincinnati and you're like, oh, that was there. I'm always like, there was a saloon there. There was a saloon there. There was a saloon there. And that just kind of and to think that you are walking back in time in the footsteps of other people who were here that you read about.
To give you just one example, if you ask somebody in Cincinnati today, you know, what was drinking like back in the past, they will always talk about beer.
Yeah,
they will act like
always.
Nobody drank anything except beer in Cincinnati. And when Molly starts in about rectified whiskey, one of these days, somebody's going to make a horror movie and call it rectified whiskey.
It wasn't how we drink whiskey today.
No.
It's very interesting. Yeah, there's, but just the way that people did everything back in the old days was different, you know? And a lot of times we can see how it evolved to things that we do today, which is cool. So
I thought, unless you have another question, Sherry, we would go out on, not to put you on the spot, but...
But we do that. Go ahead.
Yes. and I'm also looking for like another good, great headline. But what, as you've been, you know, researching and going about your historical research, what is the weirdest thing recently that you came across?
Oh, crap. I don't know. There's so many. Oh, well, so I found this in the newspaper. It was in the Enquirer somewhere.
And it had to be true then.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And I wish I could find it. It was one of those things where I was looking up something else and I ran across the story. And I really do need to find it because I want to put it in the book. But there was a time when the Ohio River would freeze over. You know, it would just freeze over solid. And I'm not just talking about 1977. This was in the 1800s. And there was a gentleman who owned a saloon that is right on Front Street that overlooked the, public landing. And he's sitting there watching all these people like ice skate and play out on the ice. So he got the idea to load up a sled with a bunch of whiskey and beer and put a little shed and a little potbelly stove and went out on the ice and set up shop right in the middle of the ice selling liquor. Well, he had his little potbelly stove and of course that all of a sudden he's like, oh, I feel a cold draft. And he looked behind him and that potbelly stove melted to the bottom of the river. And I'm sure it's still there. It's kind of cold. But I thought that was it was really strange and awesome. I love that. I wish I could find it.
That would be something. We'll send some divers down.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. You're like,
on the mission to find Molly's stove.
You know what? Jeff might be able to find that for you. I'll ask
him. I'm going to have to, yeah. That would be cool. Like, can you help me?
Greg, do any come to mind?
Oh, absolutely.
Let's hear it. I know.
Coming up, it'll probably be another month before it appears on my blog, but I'm researching blood drinkers in Cincinnati that people, particularly, there was a lot of tuberculosis going around, particularly tuberculosis patients would go to kosher butchers and drink blood as a way of improving their condition. And so Cincinnati had kind of a society of vampires, as it were.
That sounds like a Halloween post.
I know.
That's fantastic.
I'll tell you, Greg is the king of finding the weirdest stuff.
Yeah.
And you're just like, well, I can kind of believe it, but it's so freaking weird.
I wonder, did it have good marketing, or did somebody really think that it helped, and then they took it because they felt like it did help? Like, how did that perpetuate itself?
This is one of those cases where you talk about people not grasping exactly what life was like in Cincinnati. For 80 years, from 1830 until 1910, Cincinnati was one of the 10 largest cities in the United States. And so a lot of things that don't make sense when you think of, what are we now, 35th or something like that, really make sense when you realize we were the 6th largest city in the country. And there was a trend that started in Paris, went to New York, was picked up in Cincinnati, that if you have tuberculosis, you drink blood. So we were a trendsetter at the time.
All right.
That's the second weird tuberculosis story I've heard in like a month.
How was that possible?
I went to Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. One of the cave tours, and they showed inside the cave was this little building they had built. And the belief at the time was, if you had tuberculosis and went down below ground and breathed whatever you breathe inside a cave, that would heal your tuberculosis.
Whoa.
Well, I'll add one to your collection.
All right.
The Cincinnati Public Schools from 1900 until 1925 required every new school building to have open spaces on the roof so that children could get instruction in open air classrooms during the winter to prevent tuberculosis.
Whoa.
That's amazing.
And there are pictures, postcards of these outdoor rooftop classrooms at the Cincinnati Public Library.
I love that.
Next week on Tuberculosis Talk. All right. Well, we hope that whoever heard this is inspired to come check you guys out in real life, live. Stand-up history. Your next event is Wednesday the 17th at Muse. What time?
Westwood. 7 p.m.
All right. I would try to get there early.
So, Molly, where can we get your gin right now?
You can get my gin at any place in Cincinnati that sells liquor. So any Kroger that has a liquor store, any Jungle Gyms. Also over in Kentucky at Party Source and some other liquor stores across the river. And any bar, any cool bar would have my gin.
That's true.
The coolest of cool bars. Well, we can't thank you enough. Like I said, it's for me, it's really cool seeing two forces unite for the greater good. This was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
A delight.
Yeah.
Oh, I love talking about Cincinnati history. I'm going to try and go to the program on Wednesday night. Jack has something for school, but we'll see if I can't get Alex to go to that. And so I can go and listen to the stand-up history. That sounds very fun.
Sounds like you're going to go shopping for some gin.
Yes. I've already had it, and I actually like it a lot. It is not sweet, and it's one of the things I like about it. It makes a good mixer. And as much as I love dessert, and we'll talk about that in a second, I don't like my drink sweet. And it's a great gin.
All right.
And I'm not just saying that because she was just our guest. I really have loved it.
Well,
happy birthday.
Thanks. Not thanks.
No, happy birthday.
It's not my birthday today, but I had one this week.
You did, and you went somewhere special.
I did, you know. So, like, I've always been a fan of New Orleans cuisine. I've gone to New Orleans just to eat, an eatcation. I don't do that very often. So I was really eager to go to Nolia, which Keith Pandolfi, our food writer, has written about. The chef has been honored. The restaurant has been honored by, it's been on the list of best new restaurants in the country.
James Beard finalist,
honored by Esquire. And I got a chance to go to the restaurant.
That is a very good birthday dinner.
It was fantastic. It's in a really cool location, in OTR, right behind Vine Street. I shouldn't say that. If you around Vine Street, I guess it's his restaurant is on Clay Street, which you might not even know where that is, but it's kind of tucked in a I would say developing part of Over the Rhine. It's a small space, and it really reminded me of being in New Orleans. The chef, I immediately thought to myself, we need to have him on the podcast because he's got an interesting backstory. Ended up in Cincinnati as a result of Hurricane Katrina. And so we'll just leave it at that. But
okay, yeah, we don't want to give away all the
secrets. No, we don't want to give away all of it. But I recommend the place. And also, as I was sitting there being reflective on my birthday and being, you know, very grateful to be back in Cincinnati, and I was getting text messages and things like that from friends all over, including someone I worked with at USA Today who shares the same birthday. And so I sent her a snapshot of, like, the table and our food and all that stuff. And I was like, New Orleans vibe in Cincinnati. And she was like, oh, I'm so jealous. And people that don't live here but know about it are jealous. So I was feeling my Cincinnati moment was feeling like sometimes I take the place for granted. And I didn't want – that night I wanted to really, like, enjoy – all the wonderful things.
Did you pick it or did Lauren like surprise you? I hinted at it, because
it's very difficult to get a reservation there now. I mean, the earliest, because I'm old now, I just had a birthday, but the earliest she could get on a Tuesday night, and I don't know how early she tried, was 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night. I mean, that's like New York dinner time, right?
But it's also the new dinner time. It actually makes you hip and cool.
Well,
like that's like the new thing. It's like eating early.
I need all the help I can get with that. But and before that, we had a cocktail at Ghost Baby.
Oh, fun.
And on a Tuesday night, they had this brother and sister jazz act. The brother played jazz guitar and his sister sang and played.
You never know what you're going to find in there. Like any different sort of like entertainment. It's amazing in there.
And I'm like, here I am sitting in a prohibition era booze tunnel, listening to jazz, live jazz, well played. Like, you know, they were fantastic on a Tuesday night. So
I like it.
My birthday was one big Cincinnati moment.
All right. I think we'll leave it at that. And then I had a great dining experience last night. And we're going to let Keith write his story next week. And I'll talk about it at the end of next week's podcast.
That sounds good.
An amazing meal that I'm still thinking about, like today. So,
still thinking about it.
Yes. Oh, wait, I'll say I went to Colette, but I'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
And it was incredible.
Oh, Lauren wants to go there. She has an unofficial aunt in her family who's French. You know that like family friend that's around so much that you think, you know, when you're little, you think it's an
aunt. Aunties.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay.
I'll have to give her the tea. It was incredible.
All right.
Like every part of it.
All right. Well, now you've made me hungry again.
Okay.
So let's call it a wrap.